time is done.
Hi, and welcome to another probing episode of The Cyber Show. Today we're in the chair with Dr. Kate Brown, and we're talking about online dating and how people meet each other using our phones. Do online dating apps lead to healthy and successful relations, or are they just best for hookups and fun?
So, welcome back to The Cyber Show, Kate.
Hello, thank you. It's great to be here. We wanted to talk about internet dating.
Oh yeah, internet dating.
Absolutely, or online dating.
Before we do that, let's talk about love.
Love?
Yeah, let's talk about love.
Well...
Because you're about to be a PhD in love.
Yes,
I am. You actually just submitted your final draft, your doctoral thesis.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell the listeners what it's like to be a doctor of love?
It's riveting.
What's it all about then?
Well, my thesis is about therapeutic love, about it was a case study of an institution, and it was about how emotional involvement with people who've suffered trauma and disrupted attachments can be incredibly important and helpful, and that enables a person who otherwise might live quite a limited and maybe problematic life. It can be the thing that's curative. There is a saying that hurt people hurt people. And so I think that that's the kind of baseline that we start from. And I think that my research showed I basically took Fromm's a model of love that involves the idea of care, knowledge, respect, and responsibility. So a lot of people will come to my consulting room and might say, I love them. Meaning kind of talking, I don't know, about a partner or someone significant in their life. Someone might even say to me, Kate, I love your dress. And they don't actually mean that they love my dress. They mean they like it very much, or they think it suits me, or whatever. But with love, it is about all those things. And it's a verb, it's a doing word. So I would argue that it is possible to love someone without that being spoken, but actually it might be important to, if you're going to love someone, you need to get to know them. You need to care for them about what's in their best interest. You would have to be quite emotionally honest with them and also care for yourself in that. Take responsibility for how you are in that relationship. Also kind of treat that person as a separate human being with a mind and body of their own, with whom you can choose how you interact and how you behave.
Well, that sounds like a very thorough definition. Just say a few words about the science of that research and the research methods. How did you arrive at that view?
The science I used was archival research, and it was to study a very specific institution.
Yeah, and to look at the outcomes of various interactions and the interventions in that institution.
And the philosophy from archived material and things like that. So the institution that I looked at had formerly been an approved school, so it's quite interesting to find archived material from the approved school. So, for example, relationships with people weren't necessarily always cordial.
The love could be quite turbulent.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily all roses and smiles.
No, actually, I would say that love that is romanticised like that, even if it's not an erotic, physical, romantic relationship in the kind of rom-com variety, I would say that relationships that are romanticised as opposed to romantic, maybe there's a kind of an avoidance there, a possible avoidance of conflict that isn't particularly intimate. I think that true love is the ability to communicate in a really honest way, the kind of warts and all way.
Good. Well, we're getting quite deep there. We're going to keep it a little bit light for the Cyber Show. So there's a few things that we'd like to talk about today. The effects of technology on our love lives.
Yeah.
And we want to know how people meet each other these days. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what too much screen time and too much being in the network is doing to people's libido.
Mm.
But let's go back and talk some of the people who've written about love.
Mm.
We can think of people like Eric Fromm.
Yeah.
Maybe. Freud wrote about love, right?
One of my favourite quotes from Freud is from Civilizations and Its Discontent. He says that we are never so vulnerable as when we love.
Good quote. You also drew a lot from John Bowlby and Winnicott. Now, those guys, in my understanding, are kind of deal with formative childhood experiences and how that affects our capacity for relationships later on in life.
Yep, they do.
Is there something that stood out from your research that you'd just like to say, summarise in a few quick words about the work of Bowlby and Winnicott, maybe, and attachment?
With Bowlby, what's significant about his work is this idea that the intimate life of the infant will shape the intimate life of the adult.
So a lot of the screen time that toddlers are getting and the lack of maternal or paternal attention is quite a significant thing that we need to look at.
Yeah, I would say.
Last time we talked a lot about ownership.
Yeah.
And you mentioned psychological ownership as being the sense of responsibility and so on. And we've been looking a lot lately at the lack of a sense of ownership that people have around their technology.
Yeah.
Instead of living in a house that they own, they feel like they're renting hotel rooms by the hour.
Mm.
That we have a displaced, itinerant kind of generation who don't feel that the technology that they have is their legitimate property and their tools. They lack agency. What does that kind of thing do to people's ability to form relational bonds, do you think?
I think that there is something about the tyranny of choice. So I've heard of people meeting online via a dating app, and when their date arrives, the date immediately whips out their phone and starts screening through Tinder or whatever, and in a way kind of barely looks up and recognises.
There's a complete lack of commitment.
Yes.
And in a way, displaying that nonchalant lack of commitment has become part of the dating game, hasn't it?
Possibly.
You have to compete to be in my A-list.
Mm.
And there are so many other good people out there, so you better be perfect.
Yeah. And yes, I think that the idea of you've got to be perfect has really destructive connotations, because actually it's dehumanising. We are not a collection of interchangeable body parts. It reminds me of a children's book where you could have different heads, different kind of shoulders.
A Mr. Potato Man game.
Yes, yeah.
I think that that componentisation, that deconstruction of the human form that goes so well with the kind of, you know, comparative shopping technologies and things that we have today. Now that leads to a very superficial and like comparing, and you're comparing their tits, comparing, oh, eye colour. Oh, but I really wanted green eyes.
Oh.
No. And that kind of a thing. And I think that's real for some people that are using dating apps like that. They're really trying to find that perfect thing.
Tragically, I think that that's true. And I think porn culture might really feed into that, because both men and women have got completely unrealistic portrayals of how bodies should be, what bodies should be doing, those kind of things. I think that add a bit of porn culture to that, and it's quite difficult.
There's a synthesis of porn culture and app-based dating culture, that there's kind of something going on, a synergy of bad things.
Well, what I don't want to do is to pathologize people who use dating apps, because I think that there can be really legitimate reasons why people would want to use dating apps, whether that is for a brief sexual encounter or whether you're looking for an LTR, long-term relationship. I don't want to pathologize people for that, but I also think that there are drawbacks, there are dangers. And I think that there are drawbacks and dangers for people who are potentially quite vulnerable anyway. So I think that if we look at different attachment styles and online dating, we might see that the 51 to 60% of the population that are securely attached might use dating apps in quite a kind of a sensible way. And what I mean by sensible is that they would be safe in how they meet people, so not give too much away too soon, won't invest in a fantasy relationship where it's almost like they would delay meeting in real life and actually finding out about that person more. And the dating app might just be a means to meet someone in real life
and see.
Yeah. And the only kind of decisions being made are, do I like the look of this person's profile? Do I feel that I want to message them or respond to their message? Do I feel that I like them enough to spend an afternoon or evening or however long of my precious time to meet this stranger?
And get to know them. Well, let's go back to that word like, because, you know, it's a very partial slice of information. The expression that I heard, like trying to wallpaper the hallway through the letterbox when it comes to how a computer represents reality. You cannot really, you know, it's like you're looking through a tiny slot in terms of what's really there in terms of information. And you have this, you know, obviously this high dimensional matrix of stuff, but its actual utility, you know, eye color, height, income, etc., is a drop in the ocean of the things that we use in a sensory way of selecting mates. Now, I'm kind of just thinking of like maybe 100 years ago, you might live in a village in a farmhouse and hardly see anyone except your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And then one day you go into town when you're, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, and you fall in love with the very first girl that you meet and you get married.
Mm.
And the reason that you fall in love is their laugh, their smell, their gait, the way they walk. It's a whole bunch of, you know, the mass, the bottom of the iceberg of communication and information that human beings have that's not, that can't be written down in words or can't be represented in a picture. So what dating apps are doing is they're just really creating introductions, aren't they? Creating an entry point into real life. And I think this is the big question, because of the way that they mesh with society and everybody's problem, which is that they don't know how to meet people any longer.
Mm.
So can we explore that a little bit about how do people meet each other these days, and what are the criteria for trying to meet somebody?
Well, we've spoken before about this idea of the role of the village in matchmaking, and kind of it all gets a bit Jane Austen, and how there might be a maiden aunt who goes, oh, well, you know, the greengrocer's son, he's a lovely lad, etc., etc. But actually, in a healthy village, there might be a sense of the elders guiding the youngers in a non-intrusive, benign way, kind of through hints and nudges. Oh, they're nice. But also there might be a sense of warning of, well, we all know about the baker's son. No, darling, you know, no. You know, he's not a good match for you.
On that subject, I just asked this question because you've worked in the Asian and Indian community. Do you think that arranged marriages can ever work?
Absolutely. I think that there is consistent research that shows that it is absolutely possible for parents to get together and say, your daughter, my son, how about it? And that, I think there are elements of that that happen in every culture. But I think that there is a world of difference between an arranged marriage and a forced marriage.
Of course, with that saying. Yeah. So outside of that culture and that tradition, for the urban Westerner, where do you think that validation of relationships in the making comes from? Do friends have a role in that kind of thing? And
I think that they do. And I think that when I've heard of people's accounts of introducing their friends to a new partner, it's quite a significant moment. It's got all sorts of significance to both the friends and both partners, because there is a sense of, oh gosh, you know, will they like each other? You know, will I be liked? You know, and actually, what would it mean if friends were to kind of say, oh, I'm not sure about him, or I didn't like the way that he did that, or I didn't like the way that she did this.
Yeah.
What would it mean? And I guess we hold mirrors up to each other, and sometimes we don't like what we see. So it could be friends see something in a new partner that they don't like. That might say something about the friends, that they are overly critical, judgmental, hostile, possessive. It might also be that that friend has got their other friend's best intentions at heart. I think it says something if a new partner doesn't want to get on with their new partner's friends. But I think that a stable, healthy relationship, there is an element of kind of interest sharing. So hopefully there can be the idea of you've got enough in common, not everything in common, but enough in common to at least have a pleasant time and for that couple to tolerate of kind of, no, we don't need to become enmeshed immediately, but we can actually just think about the thoughts and opinions and feelings that are coming up.
So in the formation of good relationships, potentially solid long-term relationships, there's a lot played by the environment, the community, parents, friends, other people. It's that there's more than a singular individual choice at the heart of the selection process. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say.
And does it not seem that technology and sort of apps in that sense are stripping that away, are removing that? Because, I mean, it does seem to be a very private affair, the relationship between a person and their smartphone, their little 6 inches of their black mirror through which they see the world.
When we were talking about you using the analogy of it's like trying to wallpaper a room whilst looking through the letterbox, I would say that an appropriate use of that analogy would be that if you are going to use a dating app, treat it like you are letting people know that there's a letterbox that they could look through. Almost like you're putting your emotional address out. You're saying, here's the letterbox that you can look through, but I will meet you at the door and I will either choose to open it or not open it, because this is my letterbox, my home, and if you want to do any decorating, we'll do it together.
Now, we used to have Lonely Hearts Club.
Yes, I remember
Sergeant Pepper's band.
The Guardian used to do Guardian Soulmates.
Guardian did Soulmates in the printed edition of the newspaper.
Yes, they did.
And I can remember seeing the local kind of free rag that got put through the door, and they were quite amusing in some ways.
Yeah, was it Barry Manilow who did, do you like Pina Colada? That's a whole kind of skit
on Lonely Hearts Club.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. there's something cute about that. Yes. But the fact that they are just these, they're basically tiny calling cards.
Yeah.
They're just a hook on which, you know, you might just decide to contact somebody.
Yeah.
And everything else comes from that. But what happens is that let's go to the technology. The technology ostensibly tries to insert itself as a mediator between two people who may have a potential relationship. And it says, I will help you find the perfect person. Mm. I'll help you find this perfect person because we're able to present lots and lots of information. Mm. And having much more of this information will allow you to make better choices.
Mm.
And we've kind of touched on the idea that maybe that's not true.
Yeah.
But there's one function that the technology does, which is it connects this emotional calling card, as you call it, this potential for connection.
Yeah.
And then the 99% of the heavy lifting is done by human interaction.
Yeah.
And by the friends group and so on.
Yeah.
Modern dating apps like Tinder, etc., which many people consider just to be hookup apps, right? They do that function. But the accepted wisdom in the development and hacker community these days is that there's a principal agent problem there. There's no incentive for the makers of those apps to have people find long-term relationships.
Mm.
Because if they do, then they stop using the app.
Yeah.
Right? So in fact, there's a perverse incentive there to make sure that the contacts you get are unsuitable.
Wow.
Now, contrast that with our early visions of computer dating. A program which you could use, and it would try through artificial intelligence, let's just call it that for now, to select from a very, very large database of possible candidates, people who would be very compatible on a high dimensional match.
Yeah.
Right. And there was one called, I think it was OkCupid. Something like that. the wisdom in community is that that was a product that was actually so incredibly successful that computer dating can be scarily accurate, probably the wrong word to use, but it can find very good matches.
Yeah.
And that the people who had used that algorithm, and this is going back 10 or 15 years, were still happily married to the people that they'd met. And many of those people had been the second or third choice that they'd used. Yeah. So it seems that some potential for computer relationship matching was there and has been buried or mothballed, because it's a bit like an everlasting light bulb.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for the commercial entities that peddle this stuff. So, I mean, that's quite scary, because what is it saying about applications like Tinder? Now, what is that doing to people? Because it's as you say, giving the illusion of choice, but it's actually doing nothing really to assist you than going up to a random person in the street who you quite fancy and asking for their phone number.
Yeah. What I think that these algorithms might do is that the user, the person who installs and uses the dating app, it might amplify their attachment style. So you might get the 51 to 60% of the population who is generally securely attached, looking for love. I don't mean already in a romantic relationship. I mean happy in their life, probably stable in their career, happy in their home, you know, generally kind of content, but thinking, I would like intimacy, I would like companionship, I would like to get to know someone. And I wonder whether for those users, they quickly meet someone who is also securely attached and they both kind of say, right, let's meet in real life. Let's communicate in a different way that's not via the app. See what we've got in common. And I think that kind of courting and mating and falling in love is often about shared interests and shared points of cultural references. It's about intimacy, of shared jokes. So someone who is securely attached might be on the lookout for that and does want to meet in real life just to see whether this person might feel right, whether there might be something like that. Someone who's avoidant might play a long time arranging dates and then cancelling at the last minute because, oops, they just had something so much better, you know, more important to do, or terribly busy at work, you know, I'm so sorry. But their intention might not actually be to enter into a long-term relationship or to meet someone who's actively saying, that's what I would like.
They might be just wanting to play games through the app.
Oh, absolutely, and to avoid intimacy.
Let's talk about how the wheels can fall off this and how it could go horribly wrong. Consider this artificially intelligent matching algorithm.
Mm.
It seems immediately obvious that if that were programmed in a malicious way, or perhaps in a way that's just designed to extract profit, most of the big tech offerings, that's how they work.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about making money. What kind of dark ways might it, you know, it might match people who have completely dangerous attachment styles or dangerous personalities to each other, that kind of thing?
It makes me think of research that shows if you get a room full of 200 people, all of whom are single, and let's just hypothetically say that these are heterosexual single people. Typically, 50 to 60% have a secure attachment style, and they might pair up with someone who also has a secure attachment style because there's a sense of, you seem okay, I feel okay with you, let's just be okay together. People who have an avoidant style aren't likely to pair up with someone who is also avoidant style because both are, in a way, too cool for school.
They'll both just be left standing at the sides of them. Yeah. They're the wallflowers in the disco.
Because I'm not really interested anyway. No, I'm not interested either. Should we just be not interested together? It's, I think, more likely people who are avoidant around use of dating apps might do one of two things. They might either avoid any in-person emotional intimacy, so never get to meet the people that they're communicating, or they might be, highly promiscuous, but not emotionally intimate with anyone. It's possible to be physically intimate with multiple partners without actually any risking any kind of vulnerability that is involved with genuine intimacy. So the people who've got an anxious attachment pattern might pair up with the people who are avoidant, because how that works is that people who are hyper focused on the other, the kind of, oh, does he like me, or is he looking at me, and who becomes very preoccupied with the other. There can be a bit of a cliche of people who are anxious and therefore preoccupied falling for emotionally unavailable partners. And what's going on in the minds of the people who are quite anxious and preoccupied might be kind of that they go a bit, oh, he's ignoring me, swoon, he's so mysterious and romantic, you know.
So, well, we could take in the computer science way, we'd figure out all these permutations, but you're saying out of some set of attachment styles, there would be various pairings of the styles that would you could kind of predict what the outcomes might be. So that's very, very interesting, right?
Yeah.
Some of those pairings would be great.
Yeah.
Some of them would be disasters waiting to happen, presumably.
And
although maybe, you know, love and circumstances might overcome them.
Yeah, and the most vulnerable attachment style would be people who have quite a disorganised, inconsistent attachment style.
So two disorganised people hooking up...
possibly.
..might kind of be a bit of a fire starter.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
What do you think are some of the good sides and some of the dangers of dating apps? And how would they more healthily fit into a lifestyle of, well, everybody, really? Because is there not a continuum of people who are just seeking company? Some of the people that I've spoken to weren't necessarily using apps because they wanted to get a sexual hookup. They're actually hungry for community, friendship, for people with shared interests. They want to go bike riding. And obviously, well, you could just go and look for a bike riding club, maybe.
Yeah.
But maybe you might approach that problem. It's a problem. You're solving a problem of finding people by going directly for looking at people. And if you're able to search a database of people who are into cycling in the local area, and you don't then go through with the assumption that, you know, you want to jump into bed together, there's actually another level of utility. It seems though that these apps are not designed for general social networking and finding of others. They're designed for with very specific outcomes in mind.
I'm aware of apps for new mothers who are lonely and seeking friendship with other mums. So absolutely, I think that there are some really potentially beneficial uses of just putting information online and allowing that to kind of be matched with people who want the same.
This was the dream of the internet.
Right.
There were several big dreams.
Yeah.
The internet. The universal availability of information.
Yeah.
From an educational point of view. But also as a disintermediating force, a way of connecting people directly together with this immense social potential. What clearly went wrong, mainly through mediated, the world's become more mediated than ever. It's not only has the internet completely failed to do that, but it's gone the other way. And the problem that has been inserted into the relationship is giant companies, is spies, is the Facebook, Meta, and so on, which have positioned themselves in what we'd call a man in the middle attack, not only to manipulate social relations, but to gather information on them, to spy on them. And so now there's a backlash going on. People have become extremely mistrustful of anything that they put online, of any app that they interact with. And the general wisdom now is so far from the early 1990s, when everybody wanted to create their homepage and put themselves out there, is that people are recoiling from it. Don't put your personal information out there ever in any way, shape or form for these data predators to hoover up.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that many, perhaps even most, of the profiles are utterly fake
Yeah.
That people are using pseudonymous data, false presentations of themselves. I mean, many profiles are just outright lies.
Yeah.
And so what you've actually got then is this quite toxic ecosystem of people who don't really want to be out there, but feel that they need to be, because that's become the only way that they can connect with people. But at the same time, they're terrified of exposing their real selves. So you have fakes, looking for fakes, meeting fakes. Everybody has a persona or an avatar. Mm. At some point, that ceases to be anything even like online dating.
This reminds me of the story of Albert Einstein and the fact that he knew the power that his physics had. He knew that actually his discoveries could be used to develop the bomb. And he wrote to the American government, who then obviously created their own atom bomb because he had told them how to do that. And I do think that this technology of hyper information, hyper communication, hyper capacity to meet practically anyone in the world has got enormous power, but it also has got enormous danger. And I think, going back to Freud, you know, this idea of we are never so vulnerable as when we love. I think that when we choose to use an app, we are making ourselves vulnerable in certain ways.
Well, from a cybersecurity view, you're making yourself very, very vulnerable.
Yeah.
But let's just be more specific. Where when we use an app in an attempt to reach out emotionally to other people, we're very vulnerable. And by app, we mean any kind of internet-connected device, really.
And the irony is that we may never form a healthy, intimate relationship without being able to acknowledge and think and talk about our vulnerabilities. But also acknowledging our vulnerabilities puts us at huge risk.
Now, the risk comes from the mediator.
Right.
I don't really think it comes from the other person, although we could go into that in a little bit and talk about date rapes and the use of dating apps for sex predators to set up meetings, because we know that happens. Mm. But we know that statistically that's actually very, very rare. But the threat, and it's a very invisible and insidious one, comes from the data that is being collected on you by these mediators.
Yeah.
And how they can use it to manipulate you, to advertise to you, to and so on.
Also, what I wanted to say is I think that there is another danger that hasn't been mentioned in this conversation, that people are so hooked into their own black mirrors of constantly looking at that 7-inch screen. Oh, did that person kind of swipe right on me that, you know, I swiped right on, and kind of that they ignore the fact that actually, hang on, there's a really lovely barista making eyes at me. If I kind of say hello, then, you know, actually that could be the start of something beautiful.
But you're just cut off from the real world.
Exactly.
Or you've got your nose stuck in that.
You miss the cue of a friend saying, have you met my colleague? He's lovely. Or you miss the in-person reaction, or you're staring into your phone rather than actually clocking that, oh, he walks his dog at the same time as I do, and maybe if I make contact with him, then actually that could be great.
Lost in that phone, you're missing all of those lovely people walking right by, making eyes at you.
It reminds me of the scene when Mfanwe says to David, oh, you could have had some action there, but he's too busy talking about being the only gay in the village. I think that sometimes people are so caught up in their life narratives that they...
Yeah, that's a real tragedy, isn't
it? What would you say are the basics that our listeners, if they are hypothetically a 20-year-old who wants to go on dates, what would you say about how to do that safely via a dating app?
Well, I would say you take it very slowly.
Right.
And you should build up a kind of knowledge.
Okay.
You should build up a recce on them.
Right.
You know, you should do your due diligence and test them.
Right. What would due diligence and tests, and what kind of taking it slow, what would taking it slow mean?
Finding out if their stories check out.
Okay.
And I think that people that are careful, vigilant in real life relationships, yeah, do that anyway. So, you know, you said that you worked in the city and had a job, but, you know, why are you driving this beaten up Mini?
Yeah.
You know, you said that you love pets and animals, but you don't have any, and like you were very scared of that dog. You know? Things, little things that didn't check out. And it's the little things that don't check out that soon add up to a kind of picture of suspicion.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's able to do that. They might feel a bit uncomfortable about doing it, but you kind of should. And I think women naturally can do it. And they're in a position maybe where they should do it more. And time, you know, it's interesting that a lot of the wisdom that goes with this area of safely checking people out applies equally to not getting scammed, to defeating phishing attempts, and things like that. I mean, it's very important who initiates the contact, and where the instigator relationship comes from. Who is the person that brings things up the most? You know, is it a kind of just always seems to be going one way? You're always asking me questions, or I'm always asking you questions. Which way? Do you talking about yourself quite a lot, or are you sort of overly interested in me? Are you asking me too many questions? That's that kind of meta-analysis of how the relationship is developing could throw up a lot of signals. But you would only find that out over a significant period of time. And that's why you need to have a sort of, first of all, a build-up period and a cooling-off period, and then a decision-making period that kind of happens in the plateau of the initially non-sexual or not, perhaps even non-real-life relationship, exchanging emails or phoning.
Yeah.
There's a natural escalation of contact, isn't there? I think maybe an email, text messages, talking on the phone.
Yeah.
And then maybe meeting with a group of other people, with friends meeting friends kind of thing. And don't be tempted to shortcut those because you have a flutter in your tummy and a sudden passion or a kind of crazy idea that I know this is just the right one.
Or that you're under pressure to meet in real life too soon. I mean, what I was thinking is that a lot of the due diligence and reconnaissance that you're talking about is as important offline as it is online, because the drawback of meeting someone online is that there is a whole load of non-verbal stuff, non-language stuff, like how someone sounds, how someone smells, how they move, their body language, all those kind of things. But often when you meet someone offline, you have an opportunity to observe how they behave. So for example, if a couple get together in a work situation or at college or something like that, then although that they both might attempt to portray themselves as the best charismatic stuff, but actually when we encounter each other in real life, we see more about that person. So it might be the case of, oh, did you see how he spoke to his secretary? What a knob. I don't want to go out with him because I've seen how he treats someone.
I know that some people will do this with meetups. They will set the rendezvous point where they know that they can observe the other person by getting there a bit early.
Yeah.
Observe them off guard.
Yeah.
You really do want, that's good intel.
Yeah.
Is to be able to see the other person in their natural habitat, not when they've made a massive effort.
Yeah.
Not when they've just put on their best clothes and done their hair and are in kind of job interview mode, where they're going to put their best foot forward. But what they look like in their dressing gown on a Sunday morning at 11 o'clock with no makeup, kind of coming out to walk the dog.
Yeah.
Then there's the real person.
Yeah.
And if you love that person, if you like that person in their ordinary habitat, that's obviously much more valuable than it is to meet them at some kind of presentation.
Yeah, and I think we've got to something there, that actually what people encounter online is often the airbrushed Instagram fake version of people's lives that they are heavily curating and are putting out there with a very specific agenda to get the response that they want.
Absolutely. Let's talk about something even darker or something a bit even weirder and more fucked up.
Go on.
That there are evidently a lot of guys around,
right,
who are incapable of having physical sexual relationships.
Right.
Wants them, but can't cross the threshold to having them.
Right.
And are interested really in the objectification, the chase of an objectified female image.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure if this applies the other way around. I don't have enough intel on it, really, if women are getting into this as well. But what's filling that space is AI girlfriends, is virtual girlfriends.
Right.
So they're an avatar. It's an animated avatar, a sexy animated avatar.
Yeah.
It's photorealistic, perhaps. You can design it. You can find any form or figure that you want, and you can have a computer-generated, artificial intelligence-made version of that person. And now you connect that to chatbots. So it looks like it's talking to you, and it has a personality. But of course, that personality is perfectly adapted to your desires and needs. So you can have this very fulfilling relationship, and in fact, guys fall in love with these virtual girlfriends, the non-existent characters. And they serve that need of pseudo companionship. You know, that's a real thing. And I wonder where that's going. I wonder, is that maybe feeling some need in a sort of like medicinal way? It's for people who are so disconnected from reality that they can't form relationships. Or whether it's just humanity spiraling the drain, and the only thing that can come out of that is kind of misery, and that it would be fueling the incel thing.
I would say that it is potentially an extreme form of avoidance, because I happen to believe that machines, yes, they might be able to mimic very, very well human interactions, but going back to Fromm, you know, there will never be genuine care. Machines will never be able to take responsibility. They won't know you as a person. And actually, I wonder about someone's self-respect when they want to love or be loved by a machine rather than a real-life human being. And I think that it's potentially the antithesis of avoidance.
Well, it's partial avoidance.
Yeah.
Just give me my opinion. It's, people that partake of that kind of thing are not interested. They don't want any of those qualities. They don't want to be genuinely cared for or held in mind and so on. They want the simulation of it. They want the superficial effect of what that feels like. And they know damn well that an artificial intelligence cannot love them. In the same way that they know what a sex toy, a fucking machine, is not getting sexual pleasure from having an encounter with you. It's a solipsistic, it's an entirely one-sided relationship. It's not even a relationship, experience, in which none of those things matter.
Yeah.
And it seems to be on the up. It seems to be that people are seeking experience on those surface values without human connection, and that they're very hungry for more of that. An important quote to hold in mind, that technology is a way of not having to experience reality. That's from Max Frisch, who was an artist. And the not experiencing humanity, that's the function that it's performing for those people, right?
And I wonder that the real danger in that is that it is dehumanizing, and that it will lead to actual misogynistic violence in real life by people who've become desensitized to the intricacies and intimacy with a real life flesh and blood human being. And I think that is the real danger about that, that it stokes people's fantasies.
It does, and it validates them as actual experiences, because many lads will be abusive to these virtual girlfriends. And you can even program, so you can make the AI so that it's docile and agreeable and
masochistic. Yeah.
Responses to your abuse can then start going around in the real world with the attitude that, well, that's how real women respond.
With no reality confrontation of
a slap in the face.
Yeah, of you're being a total jerk. You've got a drink over your head.
Yeah, but it's worse than that.
Yeah. You
know? Okay, so there's that on the horizon. Well, not even on the horizon. There's that coming into the mix now. So just to sum up then, what's the long and short on dating apps? Is it a dystopian horror show, or are these actually something that can make people's lives better?
My response is it can be both, and to be cautious and to actually look around as well as down at your phone.
Brilliant. Thanks for being with us on The Cyber Show, Kate.
Great. Shall we have hot chocolate?
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. That's all from Kate and Andy today. We'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in.
The Cyber Show.